Hello, welcome to Tea Time History Chat Live on the British History Channel with me, Philippa Lacey Brule. Thank you for joining me today. I'm going to cover some events which have happened this week in history, so some anniversaries. We're going to go way back to 978 with the murder of King Edward at the gates of Corfe Castle, then to 1566 and the public execution of Archbishop Cranmer, and then our headline event for today, the final days of Elizabeth I in 1603. So this is Tea Time History Chat Live, like I say, on the British History Channel. I'm streaming live on YouTube and Facebook today, and a warm welcome to you if you're joining me live, and also to you if you are watching back on the catch up or indeed listening on the podcast. Before I get on to today's topic, let me remind you what we're doing tonight on History After Dark. If you've not been party to History After Dark yet, then come along, give us a go, and see how you like. We're on our how you like us. We're on our History Heroes series at the moment, and tonight we're discussing Alfred the Great. I've been spending a lot of time preparing for tonight. For this evening's discussion. So you can join me and the girls, Catherine and Kat. We're live later on at 8:15 p.m. UK time on the History After Dark channel. I've also been preparing, I'm spending a lot of time preparing this week for this coming weekend's Stuart Online History Festival. Got a great lineup. I may as well show you the lineup. So we've got a great lineup. We've got six talks going live between Friday and Sunday, and there are two live events also on Sunday evening. The first of which is a live question and answer session with all of the speakers there available to answer your questions. And then following that, there will be a live just for fun quiz, which will all the questions are based on the talks. So what you'll have heard. Even if you haven't had a chance to watch all the talks by then, come along anyway, because it's a bit of fun. And we'll also do the free prize draw during that live event. So I can see Anne, Laurie, and Beverly. Welcome, Sunny in Kent, Beverly. Look at you. It's all very cloudy here. So I hope the sun does start to pop out. It's been a very long, dull winter. But yes, but this weekend this will help. This will help, I think. A little segue. We've got, I'm just putting it up on the screen now, the six talks. So Gareth Russell is talking to us about Anna of Denmark. So his talk is The Life of a Stuart Queen, Anna of Denmark. She was a one. She's very interesting. She's very, very interesting. Costa there in Cyprus, where I'm going to be going on my summer holidays this year, actually. Lots of history where you are. Yes, do join the live event. I will give you a few more details on how to and the price as well in a moment. So you've got Gareth's talk on Anna of Denmark. She, of course, was the queen of James the First. I myself are then going to be talking about the gunpowder plot. I've called it Oppression and Broken Promises, the Roadmap to Planning an Atrocity, which is quite a long title. And I took a very long time to try and come up with one. What I'm focusing on is why, how, what were the motivations behind the gunpowder plot? How did it get to such an extreme plan, which it really was. So I also go into why there's elements to the plan and lack of actually after plan that aren't you don't really hear discussed so much. So I've gone into that in my talk as well. And then we have Andrea Zuvich talking about royal mistresses of the Stuart court, so the tenuous power of beauty at the Stuart court. Julian Humphreys is talking about this incredible 6 week on the run, this period of 6 weeks where Charles II was on the run following the final battle of the English Civil Wars, which was fought in Worcester, a town not, well, city not too far away from me. And his talk is all about that, A Hunted King, the escape of Charles II after the Battle of Worcester. We have Professor Alice Hunt joining us for her first online history festival. She's got a book coming out soon about Oliver Cromwell and the English Republic. And I'm not sure if that's the title of her book, but that's certainly the title of her talk. And that is the topic of her book. And then finally, we have Katie Wignall, who is... if you haven't followed her already on Instagram, do so. She's at Look Up London. She's a qualified blue badge guide in London, and she has done a virtual walking tour for us of the Great Fire of London. So you can get your tickets at thestuarts2024.eventbrite.co.uk. They are £21.50. So all of those talks, I mean, that's the price of one talk usually at a history festival, but that's the price for all of the talks and the online event, and sorry, in the live events. The tickets are £18. So if you are a member of my Patreon, the British History Patreon, so if you go, if you're a member, make sure you go and find the link which is pinned to the top in Patreon. If you're not a member, you can go, I'll tell you where to go in a moment, to get your discounted tickets. You go to patreon.com/British History. And if you go there, it's £5 a month, but you'll have saved £3.50 in your first week. So not only can you get discounted tickets, but in there right now is the interview with Nathan Armin. It was 2 hours. It was fantastic. So Nathan is a historian who concentrates on Welsh Tudors, basically, and Henry VII in particular. We had a fantastic discussion. He even spoke Welsh as well. Well, I think that was in the Patreon only section. So yes, if you go to my Patreon, if you're a member of Patreon or you want to be, you can access that extended interview with Nathan right now, talking about things like how Welsh actually was Henry Tudor. Turns out he was a lot more Welsh than I thought. and when exactly he had designs on the throne of England again. That was different to what I had thought. We also think we've come up with a connection potentially between Henry Tudor and Elizabeth Woodville when she was in Sanctuary in Westminster Abbey, which I've not seen ever mentioned before because I didn't know that there was this person at Westminster Abbey, so that Nathan talked about. So well worth a watch. If you are not a member of my Patreon, and you don't have to be, of course, then the main interview, so there's like an extended part for patrons, but the main interview will be available on YouTube next Tuesday. It's going to be released on a Tuesday this time because I don't want it to clash with the Stuarts Online History Festival. There we go. That's it. So let's get on to this week's anniversaries. So like I said, we're going to talk about Elizabeth I's final days. We're going to talk about the public execution of, I don't know if I get demonetized for saying words like that. I have to come up with like code, which you history, you know, buffs will all understand. But what happened to Archbishop Cranmer happened in this week. So we're going to be covering that as well. But we're going to begin with the murder of a king. King Edward. Now, this is an Anglo-Saxon king, and he was murdered at a place called Corfe Castle. He's murdered at Corfe Castle. This is a picture up on the screen now of what Corfe Castle looks like. I think it might have got on the wrong side of Cromwell. I can't remember. Corfe Castle was also a favourite murdering hole of King John, as far as I remember. But on the 18th of March, 978, the king, he was a boy king, he was only 16, a king called Edward was killed, supposedly at the gatehouse, which is there, so you can still stand where he was murdered. He'd been on the throne for 3 years. He was the only son of King Edgar and his first wife, and we're going to get into some beautiful Anglo-Saxon names now, Ethelfled. But by the time of King Edgar's death, he'd been married a further twice. So after Edward's mother, he'd married a further two times. And his third marriage was to a lady called Elfrith. And she had had a son by him. So Ethelred, although he wasn't the firstborn of King Edward, he was still seen as a contender for the throne. It wasn't exactly a system of primogeniture at this point. So Edward at the time was about 13, and his younger brother was about 7, I think. So both boys, obviously Edward becoming, not that teenagehood was a recognized concept, but becoming a young man at this point. And his stepmother, Elfrith, was the king's surviving wife, was quite a strong voice at court, but despite her putting her son forward for the throne, the Witan decided that no, Edward would be created king. And he had the support of the Archbishops of Canterbury and York. And presumably they had knowledge of him. Now, he'd been on the throne for 3 years by the time of his death. And as I suppose with every time you get a boy king, there was unrest, there were land grabs from people who thought that they were still owed their land from the church particularly. So lots of church property was attacked and taken back because it had been, there's a Anglo-Saxon England is fascinating because it is very complex, and the rise of Christianity happened during the Anglo-Saxon period. With, you know, if you're going to have a monastery, if you think about the monasteries that, just as by way of illustration, that get built and have land, that land once belonged to somebody else. It has to come from somewhere else. Anyway, so during Edward's reign, you see some unrest and people trying to grab back the land. So there's unrest. That's not great. Now, when Edward visited Corfe Castle, he was there to visit his half brother. So his little half brother who lived there. This is Corfe Castle is in Dorset, so on the south coast. Don't really know why Edward was going to visit him, or what kind of relationship the boys had. But rather than him being welcomed into the castle, he was kept waiting at the gates and offered a cup of mead. And while he was distracted with being offered this cup of refreshment, mead is very nice if you like it, very sweet. But anyway, while he's being offered this cup of refreshment, he's pulled off his horse, or pulled down from his horse and stabbed. And the reason I say he's not pulled off his horse is because the horse then bolts, and poor Edward's foot is still in the stirrup, and so he's dragged along the ground. So horrible and tragic death. Now, nobody was officially blamed for the murder of the king at the time, but many people pointed the finger at his stepmother, at Elfrith. Obviously, the motivation being that with Edward out the way, her son, Ethelred, would be able to become king. Perhaps she could have a bit of power as mother of the king. There's also in Mark Morris's book about the Anglo-Saxons, which I thoroughly recommend. He talks about some question over the legitimacy of the first marriage, and so perhaps Elfrith justified her actions in that way, that her son was actually the only legitimate and legal heir. I don't know, but he was Edward was buried in a grave near Wareham, without ceremony to begin with. But a year later, he was moved to Shaftesbury Abbey. He was given a proper ceremony. And he was already being seen as a martyr saint. So he's known, you might know him as Edward the Martyr. And of course, his death, who knows what kind of king he would have been. He dies at 16. His younger half-brother now, who becomes king, you probably have more likely to have heard of Ethelred. Ethelred the Unready assumes the crown. Now we know him as Ethelred the Unready. That's Subercate has been dismissed somewhat. He did have a, let's call it, nickname during his lifetime and afterwards, and it was a pun on his name, like Ethelred the Unready would be. The unready part is supposed to mean ill-counseled. Excuse me for a moment. Ill-counseled. Now, his name, Ethelred, in Old English means noble counsel. And the Old English for sort of ill-counseled is, I don't know how to pronounce it, unread. So he's like Ethelred the Unread. It's always like the noble counsel, ill-counseled. It's like this contradiction in terms. So that's where we get this idea of Ethelred the Unready. Not unready, but not exactly wise. We could go into him in another time, but he messes up quite royally by trying to pay a standing Danish army who eventually get bored and it doesn't go so well. But anyway, so there's one anniversary this week. Edward the Martyr is killed outside of the gates of Corfe Castle in Dorset. So that was right back into Anglo-Saxon period. I love the Anglo-Saxons. I'm really getting into it. Like I said, remember tonight, History After Dark, we're talking about Alfred the Great, who lives about 100 years beforehand. Yeah, about 100 years before Edward. So the next anniversary I thought we could cover today is here's my pictures of Edward taking the drink. I forgot I'd got these. These are some later illustrations of Edward taking that sip of mead with this. You've got a couple of depictions here, but this rather sinister looking man coming up behind him with a dagger ready to do to him. And you can see in the depictions as well, it's that there's a lady, or in fact giving him the cup in one and just looking on in the other, and that's depicting his stepmother, Queen Ealhfrith, whose son then obviously took the throne. Next, right, let's talk about Thomas Cranmer. He was executed 21st of March 1556. Now, Cranmer was the first Protestant Archbishop of Canterbury. And in March 1556, he was burnt at the stake in Oxford as a heretic. So now, this is during the reign of Mary the First, fervent Catholic, who of course gains herself the sobriquet Bloody Mary for the number of so-called heretics who were put to death during her reign. And Mary had a direct hand in Cranmer's fate. So let's look at him a bit more and why she hated him so much. So he was born in 1489. He was the second of brother of three sons of minor gentry. So there was enough land for the eldest son to inherit and make a living, but Thomas and his younger brother joined the clergy, which was not uncommon, and it was a good source of wealth. You know, it was a good career to get into at this time. And he rose up in the ranks, and he was introduced to Henry VIII during Henry's Great Matter, this 6 years protracted negotiation, trying to get a divorce from Catherine of Aragon, trying to persuade other people that it was the right thing to do and that God wasn't on his side. Clearly, it wasn't on his side, so he should get a divorce from Catherine of Aragon. But he wasn't, it was a matter of doctrine and it was debated. But Cranmer showed willingness to advocate for Henry, and he even went over to Rome to plead the case with the Pope. And it was May 1533, Archbishop Cranmer pronounced the judgment that Henry's marriage to Catherine of Aragon was unlawful. It was against God. And he threw in a threat of excommunication if Henry were to go anywhere near Catherine. So this was key. I mean, whether Henry asked for it, whether he had done the next bit or anyway, but so Mary's mother, Catherine of Aragon, is banished from court. And of course, Mary is demoted from being a princess to being Lady Mary and known as now a royal bastard. She's illegitimate. She's also barred from seeing her mother. So not only is Catherine of Aragon banished from court, but Mary isn't allowed to go to her to see her. And Mary's about 17 at this point. Very close to her mother. Must have been absolutely heartbreaking. And Cranmer is behind not just the annulment of her parents' marriage, but this banishment. He's certainly given Henry the justification for it, but banishing her mother from court. He's also, with the help of Thomas Cranmer, responsible for the approval of the translation of the Bible into English, and in 1549 also had a hand in completing the Book of Common Prayer. This would have been totally against what Mary believed. Then, another thing, later on, in the reign of Mary's half-brother, Edward VI, he supports supplanting Mary, of course, with the Protestant Lady Jane Grey. So when Mary does become queen, obviously decisively grabs back the throne from Jane, Cranmer has a target on his back, not least for his part in elevating Jane to the succession and the throne, for which he's then accused of treason. And at his trial, he defends himself admirably. He's a very learned man. I'm sure he was a good speaker, clearly, with his role. I imagine he was quite charismatic. These kind of, people are. But of course, the outcome's got to be foregone conclusion. And Cranmer was formally stripped of his offices. Now, Mary and her council were not done with Cranmer yet. And they thought that, well, they were determined to force that his punishment was based on faith rather than just being a legal issue. So this, sort of behind doors court case was not enough. They saw him as an arch heretic and wanted a public propaganda campaign against him. Well, yeah, sort of thinking, I suppose, that if you could denounce him, that people would follow and return to Catholicism. He was in prison at times with Hugh Latimer and Nicholas Ridley, and they for being heretics, and they were put to death in October 16th, 1555, so the year before Cranmer is executed. Latimer he died fairly quickly. He was overcome by smoke. Unfortunately for Ridley, the fire around him was higher, so he didn't inhale any smoke, and his took a lot longer. And Cranmer had been forced to watch. Everything was being done to try and break Cranmer's spirit and his body. Body was held in prison. And it worked. So whilst he was in prison, Cranmer signed 5 documents asserting that whatever was decreed by the monarch and parliament must be followed by all Englishmen. So, and of course, that's Mary and her and the Marian government, by association, that was seen as recantation of his Protestant faith, because he's going to follow everything Mary and her council say. His spirit was broken, and his sixth recantation was actually a direct and whole renouncement of his Protestant beliefs. He probably held out hope of mercy, which Mary should have given him on account of his recantation. But she didn't. She wanted every drop of public humiliation wrung out of this situation. This was a highly influential man in the Reformed Church of England, and she wanted to make him pay for it. Nothing really, but total annihilation of the man, his beliefs, his spirit, his legacy would do for Mary. And you have to think, this is my personal interpretation, but back to just the personal wrongs that Mary had been had endured at the hands of Cranmer. But she somewhat underestimated Cranmer. In a bid to make this as public as possible and wring the most benefit out of his recantation of his Protestant faith out, how to best do that, you need to do it in public. And on his way to his execution, he was supposed to speak in public, and a stage was erected in St. Mary's Church, Oxford. And he listened to the confirmation that he deserved death, that it was going to be by public, it was going to be in public, it was going to be by burning. And then he got to address the congregation. And they, of course, had hoped and anticipated that what he would do is give a public recantation of his faith. This is what he said, and excuse me if I read it. He says, and now, and this is by the way, recorded in Fox's Book of Martyrs. Sorry, not saying it's word for word account, but it's a very, very good account of all the people who died at the hands of Mary. So anyway, Cranmer says, and now I come to the great thing which so much troubleth my conscience more than anything that ever I did or said in my whole life. I renounce and refuse as things written with my hand, contrary to the truth which I thought in my heart, and written for fear of death and to save my life, all bills and papers which I have written or signed with my own hand since my degradation. And for as much as my hand offended, writing contrary to my heart, my hand shall first be punished. Therefore, for when I come to the fire, it shall first be burned. Sorry for messing that up a little bit. But what he's basically saying is, I signed those recantations, I signed those ascensions to Mary and her government and whatever they want to say. I signed those because I was in fear for my life. I thought that I'd get a reprieve, I suppose. And now, actually, that is such a sort of thorn in my conscience that is what is bothering me the most, is that I went against what I believed because I was in fear. And so the hand that signed those documents is going to go first into the fire. But obviously he's not saying what the authorities thought he was going to say. So he may well have said more if he'd have had the chance, but Cranmer, who, by the way, is 66 years old at this time, is dragged outside from the church to the same spot that he'd watched his friends be burnt 5 months earlier. Of course, the damage is done. He's managed to say most of his speech, or is a lot of his, enough that people know he hasn't recanted at all. And as the flames grew, he followed through with his promise and he thrust his right hand into the flames. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, you'll see on the screen now is the depiction of Cranmer with that right hand in the fire. And this is one of the, if not maybe the event in Mary's, in all these, killings of heretics, which, like I say, got Mary this soubriquet of Bloody Mary. And we can debate how much she was damaged by her father annulling her marriage with her mother, her own status then being demoted to an illegitimate child, her being forced to never see her mother again. Her mother, of course, died early, earlier than she probably would have been if she'd have been happy and healthy. But Mary could, so Mary, I think in this, she couldn't hide her true motivations. I think it was impossible for her to hide them. And I think that because people reacted the way they did to her. It didn't have the effect of people deserting the Reformed faith. Fox goes on to record all of the executions for posterity. I think it's not necessarily for her actions, but for her motivations behind those, which really earned her that soubriquet of Bloody Mary, because it feels very vengeful, which isn't it isn't an attractive trait in anybody, is it? So before we come on to the last days of Elizabeth I, which is our final story for today, many of you in the audience now, I can see, are members of my Patreon. So just to remind you, there's Nathan Armin's interview in there right now that you can access. 2 hours of brilliance. Honestly, I am almost embarrassed to say, because this means I haven't read all of his books, but one of them is coming out in July, his biography of Henry VII. There is stuff in there I had no idea about. And I don't think maybe, because it's almost like it's minutiae, but it's important. It's context. We started off near the beginning talking about the Tudor name, because I knew that it wasn't just Tudor. Anyway, really, technically, Henry wasn't Tudor at all, which is amusing and very interesting. So Gareth went through that. But also, if you go in there at the moment, I've put out a request for questions. Laurie, I know you've put yours in. Thank you. For Sharon Bennett Connolly. I'm going to be talking to her next week about women. I've told her I want to talk to her about women of the anarchy, but I think actually she's written books on women of the Magna Carta. She's written a book specifically on Nicola de la Haye, who was a female sheriff in the time of King John. So I can see me wanting to ask her lots about that, actually. But anyway, if you want to put your questions to Sharon Bennett Connolly, please do go over to patreon.com/British History to do so. If you're not a member already and you become a member, then you've got access to the entire back catalogue. So all the extended interviews, all the blogs that are in there, all the behind the scenes photos of my travels around. It's £5 a month. You can cancel any time, no hard feelings. I'm going to be asking for questions in the next few weeks for Estelle Perron. I'm going to be talking to her about her new book about Anne Boleyn and her formative years in France. I'm also going to be speaking to Gareth Benjamin Streeter about Arthur Tudor. So if you have questions for either of for Sharon, Estelle or Gareth, please do come over to Patreon. Okay. So also I should mention, if Patreon isn't your thing, fair dues, but you can support me if you'd like by buying stars on Facebook, super chats on YouTube, and what I will say is if you buy a super chat on YouTube, then I get to see it, like it pings up. So you will definitely get your comment or question read out. Right. Shall we go on to our final, the headline act for today, which is the final days of Elizabeth I. This is actually the cover to the blog that I wrote about the final days of Elizabeth I, which is in my Patreon because, you know, that's where I put them. So Elizabeth, so we're coming up to the day of her death, which was the 24th of March, 1603. She'd ruled England for 4.5 decades by the time of her death. With her death, of course, brought the end of the Tudor era, 113 years of Tudor rule, if that's really their name. and there's some symbology in the place that she chose to die. She died at Richmond Palace, which unfortunately is pretty much lost now. And there'd actually been a palace there since 1125. And when Henry VII became king, he favoured that. He really liked the palace. It's easy to get to by river from London, but equally it's quite nice and out the way. And they were there. They were there at Christmas in 1497 when there was quite a big fire, which is interesting to think if the family hadn't got out, what kind of different situation the country would have been in. But anyway, that fire was so it devastated enough of the palace that Henry was able to have a new building project and built this new palace. He named it Richmond after the title that he held when he entered the Battle of Bosworth on the 22nd of August, 1485. And it remained Henry VII's favourite palace. He died there in April, 1509. And it's where Elizabeth went back to die in 1603. So almost 100 years later. Is that right? Yeah. Yeah. Oh my God, maths. Not even that difficult maths. At Christmas 1602, Elizabeth had been at Whitehall, which is right next to Westminster in London. She'd been suffering with an incredibly severe sore throat. She's constantly drinking, you know, when you get a throat, and she's constantly drinking, trying to soothe it. She can't speak any louder than a whisper. And she told her godson, a man called Sir John Harrington, that she was eating very little. She also seems to be becoming forgetful. She would invite guests and then turn them away for having no appointment, basically, not knowing that they were coming after she'd summoned them. She was depressed. She was in anguish. The Earl of Essex rebellion had happened in 1601, and Essex, from my recall, was executed, I think, early 1602. And this is very fresh for Elizabeth, and the mere mention of the name of the Earl of Essex, Robert Devereux's name, had her weeping and beating her chest. This physically hurt Elizabeth in, you know, that visceral heartache. Elizabeth is clearly not well. Where we had with Henry VIII, this obsession about talking about the succession, it was the mirror opposite in Elizabeth. For all that we look back at her, at her reign and to her for her Gloriana days and, you know, strong female leader. I think Henry VIII could afford to talk about his succession. He wasn't thinking that in any real terms anyone was going to give him a run for his money for the throne at that point. I mean, he got rid of a few that might. Elizabeth was petrified of foreign invasion. I talk about this a lot in my talk for the Stuart's Online History Festival this weekend, if you are interested. I go into this a bit because she is a Protestant queen in a Catholic Europe, but not just that. The Catholic Europe don't recognize her as queen because they don't recognize her mother and father's marriage. So she is seen as illegitimate. Anyway, so she has been, we can look back and we know that there was no successful invasion, but clearly there was attempts with the Spanish Armada. But when Mary Queen of Scots was alive, that frightened Elizabeth to death. There were multiple plots to topple Elizabeth. So Elizabeth didn't talk about the succession. Where Henry VIII didn't seem to stop talking about it, Elizabeth wouldn't talk about it at all. And of course, we know famously that she said about, you know, men are wont to look to the rising rather than the setting sun. She feared that if she named a successor, that would be a reason for rebellion, that they would be a figurehead for rebellion. So she avoided it her entire life. She's starting to lose the power of speech. She's not well, but she still hasn't named a successor. Any attempt by those in the line of succession who'd been, they're all female, actually, those who had been in the line of succession, the Grey sisters, Arbella Stuart, when they wanted to marry or have children, that was ruthlessly counteracted by Elizabeth. December of 1602, so just before, obviously, the Christmas, because Christmas is in December, Elizabeth got news that Arbella Stuart and Edward Seymour, who were both great grandchildren of Margaret Tudor, who was the elder sister to Henry VIII, so basically kin, and both with the bloodline back up to Henry VII and the Scottish kings, that they wanted to marry. And Elizabeth is horrified. Absolutely horrified. Edward Seymour. So yes, it was Arbella Stuart and Edward Seymour. In the end, that doesn't happen. And people are starting to see that the only real thing they can do, if they want to survive the inevitable power change, is that they start supporting the most likely candidate, which becomes James VI of Scotland. Not by any, well, by this point, yeah, probably. And again, I go into that in my talk. There are people going up to see James by this point. People who were loyal to the Queen, and the Queen would have been devastated if she'd have found out, I think, how much interaction there was with James by some of her courtiers. But anyway, so mid-February 1603, Elizabeth moves to Richmond Palace, or by then, because there's a visiting Venetian ambassador, and he talks about how she's covered in pearls. Good girl. And that she recovers her wit and her humour. She's still very quick-witted, sharp-tongued. He's trying to talk to her about about English piracy. she chastises him, saying that basically the Republic of Venice only ever come to her when they're asking for something. Clearly not stealing from them wasn't a valid excuse, and she actually plays the female card and says it's my sex has brought me this demerit, which is funny. But she, according to him, she shows no signs of ill health, but she's looking old. Her hands, which were her the things she loved showing off her hands. She had long, slender hands. They were swollen by now. The coronation ring had to be cut off. Of course, this looks like an omen. This was the symbol of her marriage to her kingdom, and it's had to come off. Now, the anniversary of Robert Devereux, the Earl of Essex's execution, 25th of February, Elizabeth retreats into her private chamber. She stays away from court for a few days. And when she emerges, she's melancholy. Cecil describes her as having some strange vapors to the brain. And that melancholy turned to anxiety. She has to have been aware that people are starting to look to the succession. On the 9th of March, she is described as eating very little. Her mouth and her throat are so dry and sore. Her chest is really hot. She can't sleep. She spent three days just walking the gardens in summer clothes. This is March. So, you know, it might not have been, the Tudors had a little mini ice age, so I don't know. But she's clearly not dressed for the weather and but is burning up. And at court and further afield, you have got thoughts turning to what's going to happen the moment that Elizabeth dies. Because she looks close to death. She's taking herself away from court. You know, is France or Spain going to invade? Henry IV of France is facing the prospect of the final end to the old alliance, this alliance between France and Scotland. If James the Sixth of Scotland becomes James the First of England as well, because that's just going to be a natural alliance because it's with himself. Actually, though, the Queen's Council are more concerned with the prospect of a civil uprising from the poor. That was their main concern. And they actually convened a council on the 15th of March at Richmond to discuss how any potential revolution would be dealt with. By this point, Elizabeth she's getting a little bit past being able to interact, care, maybe. She's not sleeping. She's very weak. Her most noticeable symptom is her hand swelling, but her glands swelling underneath her jaw. And by the 17th of March, she's refusing to go to bed. So she goes from can't sleeping to I'm not going to bed. And she sits on cushions on her bedroom floor, in her bedchamber. So don't call it a bedroom. She's got her gaze fixed and her finger in her mouth. She sounds like she's so sad. It's really heartbreaking when you actually think of that as a person, as opposed to, you know, sort of Gloriana, and you think of this as a person sat. Just really, yeah. I wonder what was going on in her head, but she's visited by Sir Robert Carey. Robert Carey was the youngest grandson of her late aunt Mary Boleyn. So Anne Boleyn's sister, Mary Boleyn, her grandson, Robin Carey, comes to visit Elizabeth on the 19th of March. She takes his hand and she says, "Robin, I am not well." Which is so, like I say, she was melancholy, but by this point, she knows and she has been informed that there are members of her court who are in communication with James. Carey was one of them, but she didn't know that, thankfully. He'd in fact promised to ride to James himself with the news of the Queen's death when it comes. So the 18th of March, she doesn't attend chapel. She remains on her cushions. She refuses to move for another 2 days and nights. Finally, on the evening of the 23rd of March, she allows herself to be lifted into bed. She's not written a will. She's not mentioned her successor. And that leaves the will of her father extant. Now, that will, of course, bars descendants of Henry's sister, Margaret. So James the Sixth of Scotland by Henry VIII's will is barred from the succession. And the only way her Privy Council can sort of get over this is if Elizabeth names James as her successor. So her counsellors go to her, and by this point she can't speak, her throat is too sore, and there's a court servant, I don't know who it was, but basically kind of says, well, they went to her to name a successor, but it made no difference. Like, the outcome was what it was going to be, and the stories were made up that she either varying stories that she didn't move an inch as they read or asked her for her assent to James, or that she put her head right up to her head and indicated a crown on the mention of James's name. So the council have their permission from the Queen. They leave her, and the Archbishop of Canterbury, John Wycliffe, and her chaplains come in and pray with Elizabeth. Eventually they leave her to rest, and she's alone with her ladies, and she dies shortly before 2 a.m. on the 24th of March in 1603. Of course, the uprisings that were feared, the rebellions, the invasions, none of those transpired. There was a sharp increase in food prices in the city, in London. That was short-lived. The crowds are said to have accepted the news that James VI of Scotland had succeeded the throne with apathy. They didn't know what this new king was going to bring, but they didn't particularly wish for that things was going to stay the same. I think people just get weary in the end and want change. We see that with elections. So like I say, I take a more in-depth look at that, about what happened when James came to the throne and the context of events which ran up to the gunpowder plot for this weekend's Stuart Online History Festival. So if you're interested in that, because really the gunpowder plot that obviously comes a couple of years into, not even full years into James's reign, it would have obliterated more than just the building and the king and queen. So I go into that. By the way, if you are listening to this maybe after the Online History Festival has taken place, or you've missed our other history festivals, we've done another Stuart's one. That was our first one back in the autumn of 2022. We've done the Georgians and we've done the Tudors. If you missed any of those and you'd like to listen to the talks, each one was 5, 6, or 7, might be another 7 talks for the Tudors, can't remember now. You can get hold of those talk bundles at buymeacoffee.com/Philippa, where I've put them all, and you can buy them there if you're interested. So I hope you enjoyed that today. Remember, you can join me, Katrina Marchant, Catherine Ibbotson, who I keep still trying to say Brooks, she changed her name. You can join us tonight on History After Dark discussing Alfred the Great. Was he great? We shall find out. We're spreading Alfred over two nights to over 2 weeks because his story is so big. You can join me tonight live 8:15 on the History After Dark channel. You can join me next week, same time here. I will be going through the mottos and badges of Henry VIII's wives. I have done a video on that in the past, but I thought that's quite interesting. If you missed last week, I was talking about Roman Britain, so you can go back and catch up on that. Otherwise, I will leave you to your day. Thank you so much for joining me, everybody, and have a great day. Speak to you later. Bye.